Hey, everybody, welcome to the Daniel Davis Deep Dive Intel Brief, where we give you the most important things that we learned this week to make sure that you didn't miss anything. Let's start off with the most recent things, actually some things that we've told you about during the week and other things you haven't heard about yet. We're going to start off with that category first, and that is overnight, Volodymyr Zelensky puts on another good face about just how much the Ukraine side is pushing the Russians back, especially in Pokrovsk and Kupiansk.
Доповіді військових детально по фронту, звісно, Покровськ. Передусім, ми продовжуємо знищувати окупанта. І це найважливіше. Зупиняти російські удари. Як це можливо? І там, де це можливо? Росіяни всю нашу країну хочуть перетворити на те, що вони роблять з Покровськом, роблять з Куп'янськом, іншими нашими містами, нашими громадами. Зупиняти їх треба там, куди вони прийшли.
I hate to keep on using this same analogy, but this really has that look of that movie you may have seen where it was Adolf Hitler in the last days in the Reich bunker right before the Soviets rolled in and captured the last part of Berlin. And he was just giving orders to divisions that don't exist and talking about how, yeah, you can do this and you can go here and send this other combat unit over here. And here's where we'll block them and then we'll destroy them here. Just completely fictitious. And you may remember that scene where all the generals are kind of sitting around the war map, kind of looking at each other like, what is he talking about? That's what these kinds of images gen up. I mean, you sit here and he's talking about how, yes, Kupiansk and Pokrovsk are the primary areas here. That's what we're focusing on the more. And that is where the Russians will be destroyed. And we're going to destroy them in their place. And of course, that's what you'd like to do. And when he talks about further, yes, this is, if we don't stop them here, then this is going to continue on. They're going to do to the rest of the country what they're doing here. Now, there may be some truth to that part of it, because if you don't reach the rational conclusion that the war can't be fought, that the war can't even be defended and the Russians cannot be stopped, then you are going to condemn the rest of your country to that. And listen, it's not hard. And let me just quickly show you a look at the map. I mean, let's look at Pokrovsk first. And every day there's new additions. I mean, I've showed you a detail of it yesterday. You can go back and look at our show from yesterday where I go into a lot of detail on the tactical situation. It's continued to advance since then. And you see this area here, we're further deeper into the northern part, north of the rail junction right here in the northern part of the city. And you can just see, and this is now into the gray zone. This was just in Ukraine territory yesterday. Now this is controlled by the Russians. And you see, I mean, let me zoom in here. There just isn't much left that's under full Ukraine control. I mean, it could literally be within days. I mean, not even a week potentially. I mean, the speed with which Russia's been moving into here, this is just going to continue to go faster. And of course, in Mirnograd over to the sister city over to the right, Russia continues to fight in the southern part of Mirnograd and in the northern part. And then all of these areas remain in the gray zone where conflict continues to go on each side. And then we'll run on to the other one that he mentioned, which is the Kupiansk area. And again, you see the areas that are in the gray zone. There's just not much left. This here was in the day before that this new part was captured. And so you see, again, let me zoom in so you can see. This is the part of Kupiansk that is still in Ukraine control. And these series of buildings out here, there just isn't much left. And so when you hear the Ukraine side claim that we're not surrounded, well, you know, you just look at the map. There's not much left. And again, there's an issue called fire control where you have access to, there's three routes that are still going into where the guys that are still fighting in here can have reinforcements, et cetera, but they're all within visibility range of the Russian side. And there's just nothing you can do to stop that. So it's a literal shooting gallery. All the Ukraine troops that are in here, the reason why these are in the gray zone is because it's intermixed with Ukrainian and Russian forces. And so these guys are having to try and defend all this stuff. There's no hope here. So when you're Volodymyr Zelensky and you're saying, yeah, I see what it is and I see how this is working and I'm just going to ignore it and we're just going to continue fighting. That's not leadership, folks. That's getting your own people killed. And believe me, Zelensky is focused on these areas. So too is the Russians.
In two locations, in Kupiansk and Krasnoyarsk, the enemy has been encircled. Incidentally, I discussed this issue with the commanders of the relevant groups. They wouldn't object, Rinovich, to allowing media representatives, foreign journalists, and, well, Ukrainian journalists, into the enemy encirclement zones so that they could enter and see with their own eyes what's happening, and verify the state of the encircled troops.
That's, and so, you know, so many times the West especially accuses the Russian side of propaganda, misinformation, etc. Here where you see Putin is just absolutely offering, saying, hey, we're going to put our money where our mouth is. You can come with your own reporters, with your own media folks. We'll have a ceasefire for a given period of time. You can come in and you can see with your own eyes that the Russians presumably would not have handlers or anything else. They would just say, you can come in, you can go out and report whatever you see. And I think we'll get a chance to see. But, you know, it's kind of embarrassing because the map I just showed you shows you all you need to know. They are mostly physically surrounded, but all fire control in both Kupiansk in the north and Pokrovsk in the south. You don't have to have somebody on the ground to be able to tell you what the map already tells you. And the Ukraine side, and Zelensky's not saying that's not happening. He's just saying that, well, we got to kill him there. But, you know, you see, because we showed you this progression month by month by month by month, and now it's in the week by week by week by week, and now the days by days, you see this stuff is moving. The red is moving further and further and faster. So how much longer are you going to allow your troops to stay in there and die in place for a battle that's already over? I've already told you this has already happened in Mariupol in the early part of the war, in Bakhmut, in Avdiivka, in Kupiansk, in Krynki, actually, on the Dnieper River. Every time we've seen these kinds of incursions in the southern part of the zone here, I showed you just the day before yesterday, or just yesterday, actually, I showed you, where they had a big counterattack, but they don't have the staying power to be able to exploit it. So all they do is lose the troops, and then they lose the territory as well. Is this going to be the next one? Are these two going to be the next two to fall? Because I promise you, they will fall. The only question is, will they fall and you lose the troops, or will they fall and you preserve the troops and make it even harder for Russians on the other side? Because if they go for the method they've been using before, you're going to have, the Russians are going to have the front side of these two cities, just like they've had the other ones, except you're going to have, who knows, somewhere around 10,000 fewer troops to defend on the other side. That's the stark reality. We've seen what they've done so far. We'll see what's going to happen next time here. And if you did want somebody on the inside there, as it turns out, Ukraine themselves provided one, though not an official sanctioned statement, but somebody who is absolutely on the ground in Pokrovsk and gave a very definitive firsthand account of what it's like on the inside.
Врешті ми у Покровську дуже довго добиралися з великими втратами, частина людей в місті, частина 300. Ось що з групи залишилось, ще декілька людей наверху. Йшли допомагати хлопцям, звісно, в Покровську. Але тепер допомога потрібна нам самим. По місту їбашать дрони, працює РТА. Взагалі не зрозуміло, де хто, де наші, де вороги. А тепер ми ще й оточуємо. Нащо ми сюди йшли, тяжко зрозуміти. Що тепер робити, теж.
So let me give you the bottom line of what happened here. The Ukraine side, as I've told you many times, they have very limited operational, the fire brigades, it's sometimes called, reserves, that they can move from one place to another. So according to this soldier here, Ukraine sent a battalion, basically around 500 troops, to go to try and reinforce or relieve Pokrovsk, to try to keep the Russians from taking the city. And apparently, in very short order, he said about 200 of them were killed. Another 300 or so were wounded. And then he says, above me, in the building above, is whoever's left. Just consider that for a second. A group of about 500 men, and now all that's left is him and a handful above them in the room, presumably in various stages of being wounded, etc. They're surrounded, quite unlike what the Ukraine side has been saying for the last week or so. He said they're surrounded. They don't know where their guys are. They don't know where the enemy is. And so the effect, the military effect, is they're just sitting in the building waiting to be killed because they don't even know what else to do. And how are they getting medical support for their wounded? How are they going to get food and water? Even more critical than ammunition in this point. Because if you don't have water, I mean, that's like the Achilles heel. That's the thing that you absolutely have to be able to just even endure, even if you had all the ammunition. It is just as important as ammunition in a combat zone. And they don't know how they're going to get it because they don't have contact with anybody. That's one entire battalion has been whittled down to almost destroyed in some short period of time. And you can imagine that the rest are going on too, because just like in this video you're seeing right here that Gary's showing here, this is a Russian FPV drone, and that's a Ukrainian truck that unfortunately just got knocked out. And then here is, you know, one of the big bridges. I think that this thing's going to roll through in a minute. You're going to see the results of what that, but that's making down that one right there. That's the aftermath. That makes it extremely difficult to, even if you know where your guys are, to get the supplies too, because now even within the city, that makes it even more difficult to get any ammunition through. In large measure, they're reduced right now to getting supplies and ammunition via drone drop. And that works, but it's also very inefficient. And you just can't get things moved, and it doesn't give you anything. You can't move people with it. So that's part of the problem that we have there. So that's what's going on in Pokrovsk. We had Larry Johnson on this week, who had a very interesting take. He had just returned from Russia, where he'd been visiting a number, or was rather part of a group of people, and actually had a number of really interesting interviews, one of which is a couple of which was a couple of Russian generals. So he got a firsthand taste of exactly what's going on and got to ask lots of hard questions. He said nothing was off the table, he told me. And in this part here, he was answering one of the questions, one of the issues that have been raised by a number of people that we've seen on Telegram, some of our other guests on the show, that many in Russia are aggravated or upset at Putin, not because he's conducting the war, but because he's conducting it too slowly. Larry had this report.
They're very focused on the fact that they're going to win this, but they also acknowledge, you know, look, part of the problem is they're fighting their own relatives. This is a genuine civil war because the Ukrainians are Slavs, and they were, and the intermarriage that goes on between Slavs and Russians is quite extensive. You know, those are claiming that there's all this animus towards Putin and they want to get rid of him. Now, that's a very small group. It's not the majority of the population. This notion that there's great frustration with Putin over not moving fast enough, it's just, you know, sorry, that is a minority view.
Apparently it is a minority view. It is a view because I have personally talked to some of them, in addition to some of the guests we've had, but some others offline that have said there is a lot of frustration. But you can be frustrated and be aggravated that you're winning too slow. And there's other things you can be aggravated about. But if you're succeeding and you just think you should be succeeding faster, you may be aggravated, but it's not going to cause any real problem. It's not like you're going to revolt against your leadership or anything. So that's kind of part of the issue with troops. They're almost always unhappy. I can just tell you from my personal combat experience, there was a little grumbling going on at the troop level about what the higher echelon were doing. But if you're succeeding, it doesn't go very far. Everybody's got their idea of what they think should happen. But if you're succeeding, and I just showed you the map, and the Russians are, and I've showed you the data sheet that shows the balance of power between the two sides and all the things that go into making which side can win in a war of attrition. You know for sure it's irrevocably and irredeemably on the Russian side, and there's absolutely nothing that the Western side can do, that the Ukraine side can do. It's just baked in. Loss is baked in. And so for the Russian side, as he pointed out, they're focused on that they're going to win. And everything I have seen is that the morale on the Russian side in any level that I have seen is sky high in terms of units. So obviously, there's always people who are frightened. I again, even in my own Desert Storm situation, in something that we had just dramatic, overwhelming military advantage over the Iraqis in 1991, there were still some troops that I personally observed in American and M1 tanks and Bradley fighting vehicles and with helicopter fire support and jets overhead were still really afraid during the combat. And some of them were really concerned about casualties and all this stuff. That's just a human issue. It goes in. But in terms of the overall force of the war, nobody in the West should gain any hope or encouragement by any reports of any Russian dissatisfaction with the way the war is going. I mean, if you have a side that's aggravated because they're not going fast enough and hard enough, that tells you you've got another level of problem, because the other side, as I just showed you that one example on the Ukraine side inside of Pokrovsk, they're just worried about surviving and how they're even going to live another day. Nobody on the Ukraine side has any visions or fantasies of winning. And that also is something that we need to pay a lot of attention to. All right, well, that's not the only thing happening in the world. One of the other big ones that's going on is in our own hemisphere in here and around Venezuela. Lots of issues going on with that. There's lots of movement going on with the U.S. Firepower. There is a substantial portion of the U.S. naval fleets that are in the Venezuelan area and in the areas of the Caribbean Sea. Of course, we've been showing you lots of images of the Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, talking about how many drug boats we blow up or so. And then now here we see these here. Well, this is, you have the Gerald Ford aircraft carrier heading there along with its 90 combat jets and other aircraft. And we've been seeing issues here. And by the way, that Ford also has three destroyers that go along with it in its aircraft carrier group, lots of other support craft. There is amphibious groups, and you're seeing some of the training that was going on there where they were doing some live fire drills shortly off the coast. There's also reports out this morning that the USS Iwo Jima, which is a marine amphibious assault, is about 125 miles off the shore of Venezuela. So everything seems to be in place to order a military incursion. And we've been talking a lot this week that there is no military justification for this. There is no threat to the United States national security. There certainly is no legal authority. Congress has not given its authorization. There is no reason for this. And yet things continue to move apace. Now, we had Robert Barnes on our show for the first time this week. Definitely won't be the last time. Really enjoyed having him on the show. One of the things he was talking about, we aside from just looking at the military aspects of this, he was looking at this from a political aspect from the Trump administration itself. And one of the things he considered was the cost to President Trump and his agenda, even if this military strike is successful.
The new portrait for Trump 47 is going to be a hybrid of George W. Bush and Donald Trump. He increasingly looks that way, and I don't think that's good politics for him personally or the Republican Party. And then what you're likely to get is impeachment hearings that have actually more merit, more evidentiary foundation than all the past bogus ones did. That could drag out for months and months, derail the second half of his second administration in such a way he's not able to achieve much of anything. And the question is Maduro worth all of that? I have yet to hear a political argument, just from a pure political reasoning, why Maduro is worth the president sabotaging the second half of his second term, getting ground down into a ceaseless impeachment proceedings over whether he went about this conflict in a constitutionally correct way.
And that is a lot more important than it may appear. There has already been at least one Senate vote on examining the legality of this strike and saying, and the Senate put up a motion that says we have not given authorization. That's so, you know, the advice and consent, the ability of Congress to actually provide its authority for this, its constitutional obligation that it alone has the power to declare war or to authorize lethal military power, exclusive power. They voted, and the Congress did not vote to give that power. So it was defeated almost by a party line vote, pretty close to it. Whereas they said, no, we're not going to take that. We're not going to tell the president he can't do something. So that makes this be clear on what was and wasn't said there. That does not say, here is our authorization. It merely said, you don't have our authorization, and there is no justification for it. So we do not give our consent. So now it appears that the president is not concerned about that and is going to go forward. Now, that sets up, and I think that there's a chance that this is intentional on the part of the Democrats, because many of the speeches, I saw some of them, where they said, this is illegal, it's unauthorized, and it violates the Constitution and the 1973 War Powers Act. And I recommend you go and watch that show that we had with Mr. Barnes there, because we talked a lot about those kinds of details. And they're pretty much black and white. I mean, as black and white as it gets. Without congressional authorization, you're in violation of international law, one, but most importantly for us anyway, the Constitution and the 1973 War Powers Act. So you were directly contradicting American law. But as Lindsey Graham has said many times, we've done it before, 130 times by his count. And so if you think that basically because we violated law 131 times in the past, who cares if there's 131? That's his position. And as long as the Republicans are in charge of the Senate and the House, that continues to be the case. But in the event that this blows up in our face, that we try something like this, and now so many of the people who voted for President Trump did so because he was supposed to be the one that says, no more stupid wars. I'm going to end the wars that are on the table, and I'm not going to start any new ones. And now it appears that he's on the cusp of actually starting a new one in our own hemisphere. And for all of those like Lindsey Graham who have publicly said it's a layup, this is going to be something like getting rid of Noriega in the past. They think it's going to be nice, surgical, in, out, boom, done, problem solved. This is not going to be that way, folks. All the evidence shows that this is not going to be that way. Even if it was, however, that won't change the political threat to President Trump. Because if people see that despite you claiming you're going to be this peace president, instead you're going on military and you're not stopping the other wars. And listen, let's go back to this one of the wars that he claims that he's solved in the Middle East with Israel and the Hamas area. That's not a peace. There is no peace. Let's make sure you're clear on this. Black and white, no peace there. There is a momentary ceasefire and in effect at the time. There was an exchange of prisoners and hostages. That's it. All the other things are still being negotiated, and who knows if it's going to happen. There's all kinds of violations that happen regularly. It doesn't hit our press as much, but I assure you, if you're paying attention, there is still a lot of violence going on out there. Lots of people are being killed. The thing could blow up at any time. But the issue is there hasn't been a resolution. There is no peace. And obviously, as I just told you, there's nothing even approaching peace in the Russia-Ukraine war. So if President Trump is seen failing to get Ukraine, the Europeans, to get into a unified position here, and he can't do anything to stop the war, and Ukraine, Russia continues to succeed, if he can't stop the war in the Middle East, and if he starts one in our own hemisphere and it turns into a mess, which I think is almost certain that it will, then when it comes time for the midterm elections here at this in 2026, a lot of people are going to be looking for a change. And if the House is elected by the Democrats, then, of course, all bets are off. And now then, and one of the things he pointed out there is that in the past, a lot of these in the Trump's first term, a lot of the impeachment trials were based on fraudulent information and were threadbare at best, and they end up being just blowing up in their faces. But he said, now this one, he said, part of the problem with doing those fraudulent ones or ones that don't have substance is that now then there could be a genuine one. If you directly violate the U.S. Constitution, and now then the Democrats are in charge of the House, you can be assured that there's going to be lots of hearings, dragging a lot of people in front of testimony to give about things, and pretty good chance there's going to be an impeachment, another one. And he said that's part of the problem, is that now that you have one that actually does have some merit, whether you like it politically or not, there is merit on the board. This is the law. This is our law. This is what our Constitution says, and the president intentionally violated it. So he could be setting himself up for a huge problem. And so that's what he said. This action here could sabotage the last 2 years of his administration and just tie everything up. And of course, this is a horrible thing, and I'll talk about this later, especially if it happens, comes to bear, is that this is just evidence that our political system is just completely seized up. Because they can't, the Democrats are just chomping at the bit with an opportunity to do payback on the Republicans. And that's the problem here. And I'll talk about this on another time. It's just Republicans against Democrats. It's not political figures for the American people. We're almost byproducts, and sometimes not even that. But that's what President Trump is risking, nevertheless, if he takes this action here. So it hasn't happened as we're on the air right now, and I hope it stays that way. I hope that we just get this, it was just turns into posturing, and then they don't do it. For his sake and for the sake of our country, I pray that's exactly how it worked out. Now, there's one other thing I want to talk about today, and it is related to this issue going on in Venezuela, and it has to do with the Nobel Peace Prize. The Nobel Peace Prize is supposed to be the highest award given for those who are doing the best to seek peace, that they're trying to say, hey, we see all this violence going on, and there's a better way. That's what it's supposed to be. As a matter of fact, let me just show you what it actually is physically, definitionally supposed to be. Here's what the Nobel Peace Prize is supposed to be all about. Pretty soon. Coming up pretty soon, I hope. Okay. Gary, did we not have that video? Okay, not sure what happened with that, but Gary, again, do we have those three? Do we not have any of those three? Okay, it's coming up, I guess. All right. Just give me a second here. We're going to apologize for this, folks. But we're going to give you a second. This is from the Nobel. This is a description of what the Nobel Peace Prize was literally designed to do by Alfred Nobel in his will in 1901.
In his will, he established this prestigious honor in 1901 to be awarded to those who have made the most significant contributions toward creating a better, more harmonious planet. The criteria for the Nobel Peace Prize, as outlined in Alfred Nobel's will, are both specific and profound. The prize is awarded to those who have done the most for and fraternity between nations by fostering cooperation and resolving conflicts through dialogue, the abolition or reduction of standing armies, championing global disarmament efforts, and the holding and promotion of peace congresses, creating vital platforms for negotiation.
Okay, that's what Alfred Nobel wanted. That's what he set up this whole peace prize to be, and that's what it used to be probably a long time ago now. It used to actually be that. And over the last decade or so, maybe a couple of decades, I think it's become more political. And I think that it's more like the idea that people just say, hey, let's use the Nobel Peace Prize. I'm talking even about the Nobel Prize Committee themselves to try to give messages. That's not what it was supposed to be about. And unfortunately, that cheapens it. And so over a period of time, it's become a lot less important. It's become a lot less prestigious. And really, it's not even taken seriously by people. Now, however, I think because of the 2025 award, it is now probably or possibly in any way become irredeemably compromised. Now, I think it is more of just an outright joke. Here, first of all, is the announcement of the winner for 2025.
The Nobel Peace Prize for 2025 goes to a brave and committed champion of peace, to a woman who keeps the flame of democracy burning amidst a growing darkness. The Norwegian Nobel Committee has decided to award the Nobel Peace Prize for 2025 to Maria Corina Machado. She is receiving the Nobel Peace Prize for her tireless work promoting democratic rights for the people of Venezuela and for her struggle to achieve a just and peaceful transition from dictatorship to democracy.
So she is a champion of peace, so he says. Is that she has tireless work advancing democracy. First of all, there was nothing in the Nobel Peace announcement in the prize itself. It said anything about democracy. It said about getting rid of standing armies. It said finding dialogue. Those were the things that it talked about. He didn't even mention that. And then he says that, yes, this is a person who is moving to use peaceful process to move from the dictatorship to democracy. Right? You caught that. Now then, let's see, and I think it was just yesterday, the winner was asked, do you advocate the use of force and violence to achieve your peaceful transition?
Do you support U.S. military strikes on the territory of Venezuela as part of what you call a process?
I believe that the increase in pressure and the escalation that's taking place is the only way to force Maduro to understand that it's time to go.
The only way to force Maduro to understand that it's time to go. So because you don't like him, and this is, of course, an opposition political figure inside Venezuela, who was a very good friend of the United States and was very closely tied in, even with the vice president. And now then, when asked, you just got the Nobel Peace Prize, which talks about the disarmament. This talks about diminishing armies, using dialogue instead of violence. That's the literal definition of the word. And your first statement is, yeah, I'm for all of this military power that I just described to you just a minute ago about all of this aircraft carrier, the frigates, the destroyers, the missile carriers, all the airplanes with all of its lethal ordnance, and these Marines that are apparently ready to storm ashore somewhere, take some kind of military action, kill people on the ground. That's your answer. That's our Nobel Peace Prize winner. Folks, that's not a Nobel Peace Prize. There's nothing peace about that at all. That is just another political opposition figure that wants to use violence to overthrow an existing government that they don't like. You can argue that he didn't win legitimately the election. Most in the West, maybe everybody in the West claims he didn't. There are others in the world, and certainly they do claim that, no, it was legitimate. It doesn't even matter. I don't know the answer. I don't know if it was legitimate or not. What I do know, however, is that is the government that is in place right now. I also know, and actually Mr. Barnes validated this on our show yesterday, from a legal perspective, that even if that is true, and who can say with any authority if it is, but even if it were, there is no legal authority that exists in international law, in any kind of national law in the United States, that says another government from another country, separate, can just say, I don't like the elections that you held, so I'm going to kill the guy that's sitting in the office of the president. It just doesn't exist. And now then you're talking about a revolution where you're an opposition figure and you want to rise up and kill the guy in charge or force him out by whatever means. And you're cool with using American military power to do that. Why wouldn't they? But this sounds really similar. If it sounds familiar to you, it should. Because this is not too dissimilar to what the United States did in Libya in 2011. You may remember Hillary Clinton, then Secretary of State, infamously says, we came, we saw, he died, ha, ha, ha. And what a fun time that was. And how many people in Libya died as a result of this? So there was an opposition at the time. There was a resistance to Gaddafi. And we did support it with military power, the United States and a number of other countries, especially with air power, and helped knock down his ability, Gaddafi's ability to defend himself, and then he ends up getting just brutally slaughtered in the streets in the most horrific way. And to this day, there still are competing governments inside Libya. And they went on to well over a decade of effective civil war and all kinds of violence and disunity. And of course, that keeps the country from ever healing and moving on and becoming better and having a single government that can protect its people. Now we're sitting here potentially going to do the same thing here. And do we have to go back to Iran, 1953, when we unseated that one with the CIA? We helped overthrow the legally elected government. Or do I need to go to 2014 when we helped overthrow the legally elected government in Ukraine, Yanukovych, and then put in somebody that we wanted? And then that set the stage for a civil war in Ukraine for 8 years and the war we still suffer through today. How many times do we have to keep repeating the same thing and hoping for a different outcome every time? Now, I know many, like Lindsey Graham, wants to say, hey, well, it worked for Noriega to get him. It worked in Panama. It worked for George Bush. It worked for Ronald Reagan. Sure, they violated the law. sure, they violated the Constitution, but it was a little thing, and it was in and out. It was over quick, bam, done. This is not Panama. This is not that situation here. The conditions are quite different here. And you're not going to go, number one, you don't have the element of surprise at all, and you don't have the overwhelming firepower. A lot of the conditions don't exist there. Just militarily, it's not the same situation. More likely, you're going to get something like you did in Libya. But even aside from how it physically works out, understand this, folks. The United States achieved great power status, obviously because of its economic and military power that it had, but also because of the power of its morality, even. Now, I know a lot of people just rolled their eyes when I said that because they're thinking, you know, the U.S. has always been an imperial power and they've done a lot of bad things. Believe me, I'm aware of that. But there have also been considerable period of times where we actually did the right thing, at least to a degree. Now then, the degree is vanishing. Now then, we're not even pretending to be a country governed by the rule of law. We have said for a couple of decades, you know, the rules-based international order, the United States is the indispensable nation, et cetera, a nation for good. That used to be the tagline of the Navy, a force for good, is what we used to say. That was never fully true for many of the reasons I just outlined here. But now, folks, we're getting into a position where we're not even going to pretend. And when you put off even the pretense of following the rule of law, you adopt a more and more dangerous situation to where I'm not going to be constrained by any laws. And that is where you get the seeds start germinating for authoritarianism. Now, a lot of people think, well, that can't happen in America. We've got 250 years. We're about to celebrate our 250th year. Can't happen here. Yeah, we can have some problems here and there, and we push the envelopes, et cetera, but that doesn't happen in our country. This is not like North Korea or the Soviet Union or something like that, or you know, communist China. Not like Cuba, right? But that's how these things start, friends. That's exactly how they start. Now we're not just starting. We're moving beyond start. The seeds are germinating. And just power and people being what they are throughout millennia of human history, when they get power and when they find out that there's no consequence for violating the law, they just keep going and accelerating. This, we got to get this caught. This is not just a matter of how Trump is going to operate politically the remainder of his term, depending on how this goes out. This is a much bigger issue because this is not just a Republican issue. This is an American issue because these seeds have been planted by both Republicans and Democrats. I mean, you can go back to, I mean, really, even before, you can go back to George Bush, the 41st president, and you can go to Clinton. You can go to Bush 43. You go to Obama. You can go to Trump, the first one, definitely Biden. And now then here, Trump, the second term, and you see it continues to accelerate, continues to deepen, it continues to move in more dangerous territory. We dare not keep these seeds going. It is time to kill this at the root, pull them up, poison the rest of those seeds, and get it stopped while we still can. Because there could come a day when even me making a video like this could get me in trouble, could get me arrested. I don't know. But that's where we're heading, folks. We need to take action now to make sure we never get to that point. And one of the best things we can do right now is to stop this madness going into Venezuela to use lethal military power when it's not needed or legal. That's where we are. Appreciate you guys, folks. Look forward to seeing you next week. We're going to have some great shows for you next week. And of course, anything happens with this Venezuela situation or anything breaks in Pokrovsk or Kupiansk, you can count on Daniel Davis Deep Dive to give you the update. We are unintimidated and uncompromising. We'll continue to bring you the truth and the realities that you need to make sense of your world around you. Thanks, folks. And we'll see you next week on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.